Yeah, and it's time to begin. We're now in the 19th century authors, and the style is more or less close to our type of English. The next one is in the style of Macaulay. He was an essayist. The debate between Jude.
The debate which ensued was in its scope and progress an epitome of the course of life. Neither place nor council was lacking in dignity. The debaters were the keenest in the land, the theme they were engaged on the loftiest and most vital. The high hall of Horne's house had never beheld an assembly so representative and so varied, nor had the old rafters of that establishment ever listened to a language so encyclopedic. A gallant scene, in truth, it made. Crothers was there at the foot of the table in a striking Highland garb, his face glowing from the briny airs of the Mull of Galloway. There, too, opposite him, was Lynch, whose countenance bore already the stigmata of early depravity and premature wisdom. Next, the Scotchman was the place assigned to Costello, the eccentric, while at his side was seated in stolid repose the squat form of Madden. The chair of the resident, indeed, stood vacant before the hearth, but on either flank of it, the figure of Bannon, in explorer's kit of tweed shorts and salted cowhide brogues, contrasted sharply with the primrose elegance and town-bred manners of Malachy Rowland St. John Mulligan. Lastly, at the head of the board, was the young poet who found a refuge from his labours of pedagogy and metaphysical inquisition in the convivial atmosphere of Socratic discussion, while to right and left of him were accommodated the flippant prognosticator fresh from the hippodrome, and that vigilant wanderer, soiled by the dust of travel and combat, and stained by the mire of an indelible dishonour, but from whose steadfast and constant heart no lure or peril or threat or degradation could ever efface the image of that voluptuous loveliness which the inspired pencil of Lafayette has limned for ages yet to come.
It's all a bit updated, beautified. The debate which ensued was, in its scope and progress, an epitome of the course of life. That's, of course, also what Ulysses, in a way, wants to do. Neither the place nor council was lacking in dignity. The debaters were the keenest in the land, the theme they were engaged on the loftiest and most vital. The high hall of Horne's house, with Anglo-Saxon alliteration, had never beheld an assembly so representative and so varied. Of course, that's also in a way the name of Ulysses, to have to represent everything. And so varied, nor had the old rafters of that establishment ever listened to a language so encyclopedic. And that again is something that you can apply to Ulysses. A gallant scene, in truth, it made. And now we have a list again of all those present. From time to time in the chapter, we have that kind of thing. So we may not forget who is there. Crothers was there at the foot of the table in his striking Highland garb. Whether he's wearing something Scottish or not, in actuality, I don't know. His face glowing from the briny airs of the Mull of Galloway. There too, opposite to him, was Lynch, whose countenance bore already the stigmata of early depravity and premature wisdom. Next, the Scotchman was the place assigned to Costello, the eccentric, while at his side was seated in stolid repose the squat form of Madden. The chair of the resident indeed stood vacant because the doctor had been called away, vacant before the hearth, but on either flank of it, the figure of Bannon, in explorer's kit of tweed shorts and salted cowhide brogues, shoes, Irish, contrasted sharply with the primrose elegance and town-bred manners of Malachy Rowland St. John Mulligan, He heard Mulligan is wearing a primrose vest. Here is the full name, Malachy Rowland St. John Mulligan. Now, it was Oliver Gogarty, St. John, Oliver Gogarty here. And Oliver is replaced here by Roland, and there's a phrase, I give you a Roland for an Oliver, or something like that. So we come as close to the name as ever. Lastly, at the head of the board was a young poet who found a refuge from his labours of pedagogy, school, and metaphysical inquisition, which he does most of the time, in the convivial atmosphere of Socratic discussion, while to right and left of him were accommodated the flippant prognosticator, that is, Lenehan. Flippant, and he was predicting the victory of Scepter in the race, and he was wrong. Flippant. Fresh from the Hippodrome, of course, he had not been at the Hippodrome. He had read about it in the paper because the race was in Ascot. And the vigilant wanderer, soiled by the dust of travel and combat, there hasn't really been much combat in the Bloom, and stained by the mire of an indelible dishonour, probably his masturbation, but from whose steadfast and constant heart, and these are also attributes of Odysseus, no lure or peril or threat or degradation could ever efface the image of that voluptuous loveliness, probably Molly, which the inspired pencil of Lafayette had limned for ages yet to come. And here is a bit puzzling, we can't quite know what that is, but somebody had obviously a pencil, had made a drawing of her. This will be resolved later on, much later on, by the way. Lafayette, it's not the historical Lafayette, had limned for ages yet to come. And the next paragraph, a long one, we have to break it somewhere then, is Huxley. He was a scientist. He, of course, represented the scientific advantages of the 19th century. So that's a fairly tough paragraph.
It had better be stated here and now at the outset that the perverted transcendentalism to which Mr. S. Dedalus Div. Scep. Contentions would appear to prove him pretty badly addicted, runs directly counter to accepted scientific methods. Science, it cannot be too often repeated, deals with tangible phenomena. The man of science, like the man in the street, has to face hard-headed facts that cannot be blinked and explain them as best he can. There may be, it is true, some questions which science cannot answer at present, such as the first problem submitted by Mr. L. Bloom, Pub. Canv., regarding the future determination of sex. Must we accept the view of Empedocles of Trinacria that the right ovary, the postmenstrual period, asserts others, is responsible for the birth of males? Or are the two long-neglected spermatozoa, or nemasperms, the differentiating factors? Or is it, as most embryologists incline to opine, such as Kalper, Spallanzani, Blumenbach, Lusk, Hertwig, Leopold and Valenti, a mixture of both? This would be tantamount to a cooperation, one of nature's favourite devices, between the nisus formativus of the nemasperm on the one hand, and on the other, a happily chosen position, Cupidus felix, of the passive element. The other problem raised by the same inquirer is scarcely less vital, infant mortality. It is interesting, as he pertinently remarks, we are all born in the same way, but we all die in different ways. Mr. M. Mulligan, Haig et Uk Doc, blames the sanitary conditions in which our grey-lung citizens contract adenoids, pulmonary complaints, etc., by inhaling the bacteria which lurk in dust. These facts, he alleges, and the revolting spectacles offered by our streets, hideous publicity posters, religious ministers of all denominations, mutilated soldiers and sailors, exposed scorbutic car drivers, the suspended carcasses of dead animals, paranoid bachelors and unfructified duennas, these, he said, were accountable for any and every falling off in the caliber of the race. Calipedia, he prophesied, would soon be generally adopted, and all the graces of life, genuinely good music, agreeable literature, light philosophy, instructive pictures, plaster cast reproductions of the classical statues, such as Venus and Apollo, artistic colored photographs of prize babies, all these little attentions would enable ladies who were in a particular condition to pass the intervening months in a most enjoyable manner. Mr. J. Crothers, this back, attribute some of these demises to abdominal trauma in the case of women workers subjected to heavy labors in the workshop and to marital discipline in the home, but by far the vast majority to neglect, private or official, culminating in the exposure of newborn infants, the practice of criminal abortion, or in the atrocious crime of infanticide.
I think we stop here. Yep. This is too much, too long. And you see, this is a kind of language of science. It had better be stated here now, at the outset, that the perverted transcendentalism to which Mr. S. Dedalus, Div Skepta, Harkav kind of fake names of divinity and the skepticism at the same time, they're not real titles, contentions would appear to prove him pretty badly addicted, runs directly counter to accepted scientific methods. Science, it cannot be too often repeated, deals with tangible phenomena. You know that the word phenomenon is also one of these misplaced words of Bloom. The man of science, like the man in the street, has to face hard-headed facts that cannot be blinked and explain them as best he can. That also applies to Bloom, then. There may be, it is true, some questions which science cannot answer at present, such as the first problem submitted by Mr. L. Bloom, canvas of publicity, regarding the future determination of sex. At that time, of course, you couldn't tell whether the baby would be male or female. Must we accept the view of Empedocles of Trinacria? That was obviously a Greek philosopher. I have him here. And by the way, Trinacria, that was Sicily. That is an island that is more or less like a triangle. And that's also where the Homeric killing of the sacred oxen was supposed to take place. That the right ovary, the post-menstrual period, assert others, is responsible for the birth of males. Or are the too long neglected spermatozoa and nemosperms, these obviously are medical terms, the differentiating factors, or is it, as most embryologists inclined to opine, such as, and then you have a list of actual well-known physicians, Culpepper, Spallanzi, Blumenbach, Loscarty, Leopold, Valenti. We could have the background of all of them, but that doesn't help. It's a mixture of both. This would be tantamount to a cooperation, one of nature's favorite devices, between the nisus formativus of the nemosperm on the one hand, on the upper happily chosen position, succubitus felix of the passive element. There was a scientist and biologist, Blumenbach, who posited, he said there's a nisus formativus, that is Bildungstrieb, he called it, a German, a drive for formation, not building in the educational sense, that is. And he was a kind of forerunner of Darwin. So it was a term that happened, of the nemosperm, whatever that is, or on the other, a happily chosen position, succubitus felix, that is, if you lie under, that's obviously a the position in copulation of the passive element that the woman would lie under the man. These were contemporary issues, of course. The other problem raised by the same inquirer is scarcely less vital: infant mortality. And of course, as you can imagine, there was a lot of it. Not only were conditions bad, hygienic, but many women just couldn't afford to have, unmated women, afford to have babies and become the shame of everything. It would have been a very tough fate. So many infants were killed, disposed of, or put into convents. So it shows something of the time. It is interesting because, as it patently works, we are all born in the same way, but we all die in different ways. Mr. M. Mulligan, hygiene and eugenics, you know, eugenics is that you see that only the good bodies survive. Doc blames the sanitary conditions in which our grey-lunged citizen, and of course that was true, as you can imagine, the cities, romantic as they may appear to us now, they were full of dirt and excrement and things like that. Contract adenoids, pulmonary complaints, etc., by inhaling the bacteria which lurk in dust. These facts, he alleges, and the revolving spectacles offered by our streets, hideous publicity posters, religious ministers of all denominations, he thinks they look pretty ugly, mutilated soldiers, we had a one-legged soldier, and sailors, exposed scorbutic car drivers, the suspended carcasses of dead animals, there must have been sometimes dead horses or dogs, paranoid bachelors and unfructified duennas, females. These, he said, were accountable for any and every falling off in the caliber of the race. And of course, race was a term that was much discussed. Calipedia, that is, that your offspring, the children, should be beautiful. Calipedia, he prophesied, would soon be generally adopted, and you realize this movement has gone a bit wrong with fascism and all of that, then adopted, and all the graces of life, agreeable music, agreeable literature, light philosophy, instructive pictures, plaster cars with production of classical statues such as Venus and Apollo, that comes again close to Bloom, artistic coloured photographs of prize baby. You realize at that time, photographs were black and white, but they could be coloured. Of prize babies is nice. You have prize bulls and prize sheep, but prize babies is like a competition when you. All these little attentions would enable ladies who were in a particular condition. I already mentioned that the words for pregnant were always circumscription in a particular condition, in besonderen Umständen and so on, to pass the intervening months in a most enjoyable manner. Yeah, now we can go on.
Although the former, we are thinking of neglect, is undoubtedly only too true, the case he cites of nurses forgetting to count the sponges in the peritoneal cavity is too rare to be normative. In fact, when one comes to look into it, the wonder is that so many pregnancies and deliveries go off so well as they do, all things considered, and in spite of our human shortcomings, which often balk nature in her intentions. An ingenious suggestion is that thrown out by Mr. V. Lynch back arith, that both natality and mortality, as well as all other phenomena of evolution, tidal movements, lunar phases, blood temperatures, diseases in general, everything in fine in nature's vast workshop, from the extinction of some remote sun to the blossoming of one of the countless flowers which beautify our public parks, is subject to a law of numeration as yet unascertained. Still, the plain, straightforward question why a child of normally healthy parents and seemingly a healthy child and properly looked after succumbs unaccountably in early childhood, though other children of the same marriage do not, must certainly, in the poet's words, give us pause. Nature, we may rest assured, has her own good and cogent reasons for whatever she does, and in all probability, such deaths are due to some law of anticipation by which organisms in which morbus germs have taken up their residence, modern science has conclusively shown that only the plasmic substance can be said to be immortal, tend to disappear at an increasingly earlier stage of development, an arrangement which, though productive of pain to some of our feelings, notably the maternal, is nevertheless, some of us think, in the long run, beneficial to the race in general, in securing thereby the survival of the fittest. Mr. S. Daedalus's Divscat remark, or should it be called an interruption, that an omnivorous being which can masticate, deglute, digest, and apparently pass through the ordinary channel with pluto-perfect imperturbability such multifarious elements as cancrenous females, emaciated parturition, corpulent professional gentlemen, not to speak of jaundiced politicians and chlorotic nuns, might possibly find gastric relief in an innocent collation of staggering bob, revealed as naught else could, and in a very unsavory light, the tendency above alluded to. For the enlightenment of those who are not so intimately acquainted with the minutiae of the municipal abattoir, as this morbid-minded aesthete and embryo philosopher, who for all his overweening bumptiousness and things scientific, can scarcely distinguish an acid from an alkali, prides himself on being, it should perhaps be stated that staggering bob, in the vile parlance of our lower-class licensed victuallers, signifies the cookable and eatable flesh of a calf newly dropped from its mother. In a recent public controversy with Mr. L. Bloom, Pub. Canv, which took place in the Commons Hall of the National Maternity Hospital, 2930 and 31 Holler Street, of which, as is well known, Dr. A. Horn, Lick Imidiv, FKQCPI, is the able and popular master, he is reported by eyewitnesses as having stated that once a woman has let the cat into the bag, an aesthetic allusion presumably to one of the most complicated and marvelous of all nature's processes, the act of sexual congress, she must let it out again, or give it life, as he phrased it, to save her own. At the risk of her own, was the telling rejoinder of his interlocutor, nonetheless effective for the moderate and measured tone in which it was delivered.
We are a little bit heavy and scientific, but we can follow on. This is, after all, the topic of the chapter. I may have missed a few things here. Mr. J. Crothers, Disc Bacula, attribute some of these demises to abdominal. It should be abdominal, not abnormal. Sorry, Curtis. Abdominal trauma in the case of women workers subjected to heavy labors in the workshops and to marital discipline in the home. But by far, the vast majority to neglect, private or official, culminating in the exposure of newborn infants. So that's what happened, infants. The practice of criminal abortion. There was no other abortion than criminal, of course, at that time. Or in the atrocious crime of infanticide, killing children. Although the former, we are thinking of neglect, is undoubtedly only too true. The case, he cites, of nurses forgetting to count the sponges in the peritoneal cavity. Sometimes after an operation, they forget a sponge or an instrument. In fact, when one comes to look into it, the wonder is that so many pregnancies and deliveries go off so well as they do, all things considered. And in spite of our human shortcomings, which often balk nature in her intentions, an ingenious suggestion is that thrown out by Mr. V. Lynch. Again, back, and arithmetics, because he talks about numbers. That both natality and mortality, the being born and dying, as well as all other phenomena of evolution, tidal movements, lunar phases, blood temperatures, diseases in general, everything, in fine, in nature's vast workshop, from the extinction of the remote sun to the blossomings of one of the countless flowers which beautify a public park, is subject to a law of numeration. Everything is, in a way, has a mathematical basis, as yet unascertained. Still, the plain, straightforward question why a child of normally healthy parents and seemingly a healthy child and properly looked after succumbs unaccountably in early childhood, though other children of the same age do not, that must certainly, in the poet's word, give us pause was an echo of Hamlet. Nature, we may rest assured, has her own good and cogent reason for whatever she does, and in all probability, such deaths are due to some law of anticipation by which organisms in which morbus, that is, disease, sickness, germs have taken up their residence. Modern science has conclusively thrown out that only the plasmic substance can be said to be immortal, something beyond the body, obviously, tend to disappear at an increasingly earlier stage of development, an arrangement which, though productive of pain to some of our feelings, notably the maternal, is nevertheless, some would think, in the long run beneficial to the race in general, in securing thereby the survival of the fittest. And here, of course, we are with Darwin, who says that the weaker ones are, in a way, sorted out, and only the fittest survive. So, Mr. Aristotle's divinity skepticism remark, or should it be called an interruption? And now he says something quite strange, that an omnivorous, that eats everything, being which can masticate, chew, deglute, digest, and apparently pass through the orderly channels with the perfect imperturbability. That is an expression that Stephen picked up from the letter of Mr. Deasy in the second chapter, who talked about pluto-perfect imperturbability. Such multifarious aliments, food, as cancrenous females, women with cancer, emaciated by parturition, emaciated by giving birth, corpulent professional gentlemen, not to speak of jaundiced politicians and chlorotic nuns, might possibly find gastric relief in an innocent collation of staggering balls. I've never seen anyone eating these things, but now he says a collation of staggering balls. Staggering Bob has been mentioned several times. It is in Irene. I have it here. Yes, before. I think it's something that a calf that has been born too young and cannot survive. This is really a term that Bloom has known, reveals. As not else could, and in a very unsavory light, the tendency above alluded to. For the enlightenment of those who are not so intimately acquainted with the minutiae of the municipal abattoir, that's where they slaughter, that's where the dead bodies come, the carcasses, as this morbid-minded aesthete and embryo philosopher, who, for all his overweening bumptiousness in things, scientific can scarcely distinguish an acid from an alkali. These are the basic things in chemistry. Prides himself on being, it should perhaps be stated, that, here they explain it, that staggering Bob, in the vile parlance of our lower class, licensed vitriolus signifies the cookable and eatable flesh of a calf newly dropped from its mother. So that is something. In recent public controversy with Mr. L. Bloom, pub canvasser, which took place, now they talk about the present situation, which took place in the Commons Hall of the National Maternity Hospital, and then you get the address, 2033 Holler Street, of which, as is well known, Dr. A. Horn, licensed in midwife, F. Fellow, King of the Queen's College of Physicians of Ireland, something like that. He was a real person and the director of the hospital. He's the able and popular master. He's reported by Irises as having stated that once a woman has let the cat into the bag, you know, you let the cat out of the bag, and aesthetic illusion, presumably, of one of the most complicated marvels of all nature's processes, the act of sexual congress, she must let it out again, or give it life, as he phrased, to save her own. At the risk of her own was the telling rejoinder of his interlocutor, nonetheless effective for the moderate and measured tone in which it was delivered. It's probably Bloom, he says, the mother then risks her own life in birth. That was a long one, yeah, and scientific and typical.
Meanwhile, the skill and patience of the physician had brought about a happy accouchement. It had been a weary, weary while, both for patient and doctor. All that surgical skill could do was done, and the brave woman had manfully helped. She had. She had fought the good fight, and now she was very, very happy. Those who have passed on, who have gone before, are happy too, as they gaze down and smile upon the touching scene. Reverently look at her as she reclines there, with the mother light in her eyes. That longing hunger for baby fingers, a pretty sight it is to see in the first bloom of our new motherhood, breathing a silent prayer of thanksgiving to one above, the universal husband. And as her loving eyes behold her babe, she wishes only one blessing more, to have her dear Dodie there with her to share her joy, to lay in his arms that mite of God's clay, the fruit of their lawful embraces. He is older now, you and I may whisper it, and a trifle stooped in the shoulders, yet in the whirligig of years a grave dignity has come to the conscientious second accountant of the Ulster Bank College Green Branch. O Dodie, loved one of old, faithful life mate now, it may never be again that far-off time of the roses. With the old shake of her pretty head, she recalls those days. God, how beautiful now across the mist of years. But their children are grouped in her imagination about the bedside, hers and his, Charlie, Mary, Alice, Frederick, Albert, if he had lived, Mamie, Budgie, Victoria, Francis, Tom, Violet, Constance, Louisa, darling little Bobsy, called after our famous hero of the South African War, Lord Bobs of Waterford and Kandahar. And now, this last pledge of their union, a Purefoy if ever there was one, with the true Purefoy nose. Young Hopeful would be christened Mortimer Edward after the influential third cousin of Mr. Purefoy in the Treasury Remembrances Office, Dublin Castle. And so time wags on. But Father Cronion has dealt lightly here. No, let no sigh break from that bosom, dear gentle Mina. And Dodie, knock the ashes from your pipe, the season briar you still fancy when the curfew rings for you. May it be the distant day. And doubt the light whereby you read in the sacred book, for the oil too has run low. And so with a tranquil heart to bed, to rest. He knows and will call in his own good time. You too have fought the good fight and played loyally your man's part. Sir, to you my hand. Well done, thou good and faithful servant.
Here, perhaps, you might have guessed the author. In this chatty kind of way, suppose, sentimental. That's Dickens. Of course, Joyce and his contemporaries looked down on the Dickens type of storytelling, a story. And I remember an episode that I was told, of course, I wasn't there, that Joyce at the Zurich General Post Office, Zielpost, had seen a clerk reading a book in English and said, "What is it?" And he said, "Dickens." And Joyce said, "You mustn't read Dickens. You must read Laurence Sterne. He was Irish." So much for the thing. So Dickens was the kind of person to react against. You can see that. So meanwhile, the skill and patience of the physician had brought about a happy accoutrement. It had been a weary, weary while, both for patient and doctor. You recognize a certain style, of course. All that surgeon's skill could do was done, and the brave woman had manfully helped. She had fought the good fight, and now she was very, very happy. Those who have passed on, who have gone before, are happy too, as they gaze down and smile upon the touching scene. Reverently look at her as she reclines there with a mother-like in her eyes, that longing hunger for baby fingers. A pretty sight it is to see. In the first bloom of her new motherhood, breathing a silent prayer of thanksgiving to one of above the universal husband. And as her loving eyes behold her babe, she wishes only one blessing more, to have her dear Dodi, so was the word Dickens used, husband, there with her to share her joy, to lay in his arms the mite of God's clay, the fruit of their lawful embraces. He's older now, we heard that already. You and I may whisper it, and again, that speaking to the reader is also quite Dickensian. And a trifle stooped at the shoulders, yet in the whirligig of years, that's an echo, a grave dignity has come to the conscientious second account of the Ulster Bank College Green Branch. He's working in the Ulster Bank, and we also know, Bloom has known that, that he is a Protestant, a Methodist, and still has many children. Where are we? Ulster Bank College Green Branch. Oh, Dodi, loved one of the old faithful life mate now. It may never be again that far off time of the roses. With your shake of a pretty head, she recalls those days. God, how beautiful now across the mist of years. But their children are grouped in her imagination about the bedside, hers and his. And these are the names of the children. And you see, they are English names, often based on English royalty. Charlie, Mary Alice, Frederick Albert, the husband of, you know, if he had lived, Mamie, Budgie, Victoria Francis, Tom Byron, Constance Louisa, darling little Bopsy, called after a famous hero of the South African War, Lord Bopsy of Waterford in Kandahar. So this is the Boer War that is just over, and they named their children after one of the British generals. And now this last pledge of the Union, a pure foy, if ever there was one, with a true pure foy nose. Young hopeful will be christened Mortimer Edward. Again, Edward, royalty, Mortimer, also an English name, which oddly enough, maybe not oddly enough, has the word death in it, Mortimer. Edward, who is, as I already said, the youngest character in the book, only a few minutes old. after the influential third cousin of Mr. Purefoy in the Treasury Rembrandt of the Dublin Castle. You often name somebody after a rich relative in the hope they would do something. And so time wags on. But Father Cronion has done lightly there. This is a mixture of Cronion, who is the offspring of the god Zeus and others, and Kronos, the god of time. Father has dealt lightly here. No, let no sigh break from that bosom, dear gentle Mina, Wilhelmina. And Dodie, knock the ashes from your pipe. The seasoned briar was the material for pipes. You shall fancy when the curfew rings, that is when you have to go home. The curfew is the couvre-feu. The curfew is when you have to go back, or to troops, have to go back to barracks. Rings for you. May it be the distant day, and doubt the light. Doubt is to put out a candle. The light whereby you read in the sacred book, for the oil too has run low. And so with a tranquil heart to bed to rest. He knows and will call you in his good old time, God. You too have fought the good fight and played loyally your man's part, sir. To you, my hand. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. So that is, I think, quite a palatable bit. Now there's some late 19th century, I think. The next one is Cardinal Newman. Cardinal Newman was quite an important Protestant clergyman in Oxford, but he turned away and he converted to become a Catholic. And he went to Ireland and he founded the Royal Irish University. So he's with. And he wrote a lot, and Joyce liked his style. It was clear and direct and all of this. And so the next thing is in the style of a cardinal who is very, very famous. There's still a Newman. In Newman House in Dublin, you now have an institution called MOLLY, which is the abbreviation of modern literature, but also refers to MOLLY, where they have a kind of Centre for Irish Writer, and in particular also Joyce. Newman.
There are sins, or let us call them, as the world calls them, evil memories, which are hidden away by man in the darkest places of the heart. But they abide there and wait. He may suffer their memory to grow dim, let them be as though they had not been, and all but persuade himself that they were not, or at least were otherwise. Yet a chance word will call them forth suddenly, and they will rise up to confront him in the most various circumstances, a vision or a dream, or while timbrel and harp soothe his senses, or amid the cool silver tranquillity of the evening, or at the feast at midnight when he is now filled with wine. Not to insult over him will the vision come, as over one that lies under her wrath, not for vengeance to cut him off from the living, but shrouded in the piteous vesture of the past, silent, remote, reproachful.
You can see the language is quite well set. And of course it is religious. There are sins. Let us call them as the world calls them, evil memories which are hidden away by man in the darkest place of the heart. But they abide there and wait. He may suffer their memories to grow dim. Let them be as though they had not been, and all but persuade himself that they were not, or at least were otherwise. Yet a chance where will call them forth suddenly, and they will rise up to confront him in the most various circumstances, a vision or a dream. Or while timbre and harp soothe his senses, or in the cool silver tranquility of evening. This is a kind of theological form of what psychoanalysis called, of course, the guilt and things like in the unconscious. And this is a way in which the church would and has always addressed them. And of course, it may be a word that you hear that may call them up again and bring forth. Yet the chancellor will call them forth suddenly, and they will rise up to confront him in the most various circumstances, a vision or a dream, or while timbre and harp soothe his senses, or amid the cool silver tranquility. Joyce calls Newman silver-tongued. Tranquility of the evening, or at the feast at midnight when he is now filled with wine. Not to insult over him will these visions come, as over one that lies under a wrath, not for vengeance to get up from the living, but shrouded in the piteous vesture of the past, memories, silent, remote, reproachful. And you can see the language is quite impressive, and it doesn't seem to be distorted by parody, as in the Dickens paragraph. The next now, and they get very short, is Walter Pater. Walter Pater was, I think, a teacher at Oxford and a writer, and he's very famous. Especially he wrote about, I think, the Renaissance, and had a very, very memorable way of describing it. So they were the stylists of the time.
The stranger still regarded on the face before him a slow recession of that false calm there, imposed, as it seemed, by habit or some studied trick upon words so embittered as to be accusing their speaker an unhealthiness, a flair for the cruder things of life. A scene disengages itself in the observer's memory, evoked, it would seem, by a word of so natural a homeliness, as if those days were really present there, as some thought, with their immediate pleasures. A shaven space of lawn, one soft May evening. The well-remembered grove of lilacs at Round Town, purple and white, fragrant slender spectators of the game, but with much real interest in the pellets as they run slowly forward over the sward or collide and stop, one by its fellow, with a brief alert shock. And yonder, above that grey urn, where the water moves at times in thoughtful irrigation, you saw another as fragrant sisterhood, Flurry, Atty, Tiny, and their darker friend, with I know not what of arresting in her pose then. Our Lady of the Cherries, a comely brace of them pendant from an ear, bringing out the foreign warmth of the skin so daintily against the cool, ardent fruit. A lad of 4 or 5 in linsey woolsey, blossom time, but there will be cheer in the kindly hearth when ere long the bowls are gathered and hutched, is standing on the urn, secured by that circle of girlish fond hands. He frowns a little, just as this young man does now, with a perhaps too conscious enjoyment of danger, but must needs glance at whiles towards where his mother watches from the piazzetta, giving upon the flowered clothes with a faint shadow of remoteness or of reproach, alles vergängliche, in her glad look.
Yeah. The stranger still regarded the face before him, a slow recession of that false calm there, imposed, as it seemed, by a habit or some studied trick. I don't quite see through this entirely. Upon words so embittered as to accuse in their speak an unhealthiness, a flair for the cruder things of life. If it's bloom thing or steam, I'm sorry I can't. But the next thing is puts together something we often heard, that is Bloom's memory of a garden party or several garden parties in Round Town, a Welshy suburb, where obviously Bloom was invited, and he saw Molly there for the first time, and Stephen, as a little boy with his mother, were also there. So that is something that has often turned up in fragments, but now we have it in one piece. A memory. A shaven space of lawn, one soft May evening, the well-remembered grove of lilacs. Lilac is a word that comes up. At Roundtown, purple and white, fragrant, slender spectators of the game, but with much real interest in the pellets as they run slowly forward over the sward and collide and stop. Sward is a well-kept bit of grass. And this is, as we also remember, they play the bowls with pellets and hammers, and that is where Bloom remembers that he was luckily beating Menton, who was also there. And Menton remembers it to the lawyer, and he resents Bloom. Long back. The pellet collide or stop, one by its fellow with a brief alert shock. And yonder about that grey urn, in the garden, where the water moves at times in thoughtful irrigation, they must have had a fountain there. You saw another as fragrant sisterhood. And these are Flowey Atitaini and their darker friend. Flowey Atitaini were in Bloom's memory already in the Nausicaa chapter. Tiny and their darker friend with I know not what of the resting in her pose then. This is when Bloom first saw young Molly. Our Lady of the Cherries, a comely brace of them pendant from an ear, she had over the cherries, bringing out the foreign warmth of the skin. She's a little bit dark, Jewish, so daintily against the cool, ardent fruit. A lad of 4 or 5, in Lynchy Woolsey, that is Stephen. Blossom time, but there will be cheer of the kindly hearth when ere long the bowls for the game are gathered and hutched, is standing on the urn, secured by that circle of girlish formed hands, and of course the young girls would be around the little boy. He frowns a little, just as this man does now. So Bloom remembers Stephen when he first saw him, with a perhaps too conscious enjoyment of danger, but Ned Leeds glances at once towards where his mother watches from the piazzetta, giving upon the flower close with a faint shadow of remoteness or of reproach. Of course, the mother is now dead. And then you have a strange quote in the parenthesis that we know, alles vergängliche, all that's transient, but that is also the end of Faust, Goethe's Faust. Alles vergängliche, hier ist something with Gleichnis. You may remember the end of Faust, but everything that is tension goes, bad luck. Yeah, and now the next thing is another writer, Ruskin. I think he was also an Oxford professor.
Mark this father and remember, the end comes suddenly. Enter the antechamber of birth where the studios are assembled and note their faces. Nothing as it seems there of rash or violent, quietude of custody rather, befitting their station in that house. The vigilant watch of shepherds and of angels, and that of Crib in Bethlehem of Judah long ago. But as before the lightning, the serried storm clouds, heavy with preponderant excess of moisture, in swollen masses turgidly distended, compass earth and sky in one vast slumber, impending above parched field and drowsy oxen and blighted growth of shrub and verdure, till in an instant a flash rives their centres, and with the reverberation of the thunder the cloudburst pours its torrent. So, and not otherwise, was the transformation, violent and instantaneous, upon the utterance of the word.
Oh.
"Burks!"
Oh,
exclaims my Lord Stephen, giving the cry. And a tag and
box. No, stop. So it's like a sermon. Mark this, Father, and remember. The end comes suddenly. Enter the antechamber of birth, where the studious are assembled and note their faces. Nothing, as it seems, there of rash or violent. At the moment seems to be quiet. Quietude of custody, rather, befitting their station in that house. The vigilant watch of shepherds and of angels about the crib at Bethlehem of Judah long ago. That is a Christmas story. But as before the lightning, the serried storm clouds, heavy with preponderant excess of moisture in swollen masses turgidly distended. That, of course, also refers to pregnancy. Compass earth and sky in one vast slumber, impending above parched fields and drowsy oxen and blighted growth of shrub and verdure, till in an instant a flash rives at centres, and with a reverberation of the thunder, the cloudbird pours its torrent. So or not otherwise was the transformation violent and instantaneous upon the utterance of the word. And here one expects something religious after all. There's already the sacred family in Bethlehem when Jesus was born. And of course, Jesus in the Gospel of St. John is the word. In the beginning was the word. So we expect something momentous, and we've already heard it a bit in overshooting, that now comes next.
Cocktail of all then after, Cockerel, Jackanapes, Welshire, Pill Doctor, Punctual Bloom at Heels, with the universal grabbing at headgear, ashplants, bilbos, Panama hats and scabbards, Zermatt alpenstocks and whatnot. A detail of lusty youth, noble every student there. Nurse Callan, taken aback in the hallway, cannot stay them, nor smiling surgeon, coming downstairs with news of placentation ended, a full pound, if a milligram. They hark him on. The door. It is open? Ah! They are out, tumultuously. Off for a minute's race, all bravely legging it, Burks of Denzil and Hollis, their ulterior goal. Dixon follows, giving them sharp language, but raps out an oath, he too, and on. Bloom stays with nurse, a thought to send a kind word to happy mother and nursling up there. Doctor diet and doctor quiet. Look she too, not other now? Warder watching in Orne's house has told its tale in that washed-out pallor. Them all being gone, at glance of motherwit helping, he whispers close and going, Madam, when comes the stork bird for thee?
Oh. So the word is not something related, but Burks. Why is that so efficient? Well, it's the name of a pub nearby and an indication that pubs close and have to close at 11. So it is high time for a drink, the last drink, and you have to rush out. Out flings my Lord Stephen, giving the cry and the tag and the bobtail of them all of them afterwards. And so they rush out in something that is, for me, somewhat unlikely, because as an expert in occlokinetics, I know that you can't get the whole group of people moving and getting each other's way. But here they rushed out, obviously, in favour of having a drink. Cockerel, Jackanapes, Welshire, Pill Doctor, Punctual Bloom, all of them are described here, at heels with a universal grabbing of headgear, hats, ashplant, bilbos, Panama hats and scabbards, Zermatt alpenstocks, they have all kinds of canes with them, and whatnot. A dead ale that's a group of lusty youth, noble, every student there. Nurse Callan, taken aback in the hallway, cannot stay them. nor smiling surgeon coming downstairs with loads of placentation ended. There's the placenta that comes after the birth. The end of the chapter that begins very soon can be called the placenta, something different. A full pound, if a milligram, they usually measure a weight. They hark him on. The doctor, the door, it is open, ha! They are out tumultuously for the minute's race, all bravely legging it. Burks and Denzil and Horace, their nods will go. Burks is in Denzil Lane nearby, giving them sharp language, but raps out an oath, he too, and on. Bloom stays with the nurse. A thought to send the kind word to happy mother and nursing up tail. He still says hello. Dr. Diet and Dr. Quiet. These are kind of a homely thing, you know. Take diet and be quiet and then everything will be all right. Looks she too not other now? Ward of watching in Horn's house, that language takes you back to the beginning, has told its tale in that washed out pallor. Them all being gone, a glance of motherhood helping, he whispers close in going, Madam, when comes the stork bird for thee? I am not sure that Bloom would say that, but he might as well. She's the nurse. He likes a bit the younger one. The next thing is in the style of Thomas Carlyle, a Scotsman, now a bit forgotten, who was bringing back a kind of Germanic touch to English, and expresses that.
The air without is impregnated with rain-dew moisture, life essence celestial, glistering on Dublin stone there under star-shiny Chalem. God's air, the All-Father's air, scintillant, circumambient, sessile air, breathe it deep into thee. By heaven, Theodore Purefoy, thou hast done a doughty deed and no botch. Thou art, I vow, the remarkablest progenitor, barring none, in this chaffering, all-including, most ferraginous chronicle. Astounding. In her lay, a God-framed, God-given preformed possibility, which thou hast fructified with thy modicum of man's work, cleave to her, serve, toil on, labour like a very band-dog, and let scholarment and all methusiasts go hang. Thou art all their daddies, Theodore, art drooping under thy load, be moiled with butcher's bills at home and ingots not thine in the counting-house, head up. For every new begotten, thou shalt gather thy homer of ripe wheat. See, thy fleece is drenched. Dost envy Darby Dulman there with his Joan? A canting jay and a rheumy cur-dog is all their progeny. Pshaw, I tell thee. He is a mule, a dead gastropod, without vim or stamina, not worth a cracked kreutzer. Copulation without population, no, say I. Herod Slaughter of the Innocents were the truer name. Vegetables, forsooth, and sterile cohabitation. Give her beef steaks, red, raw, bleeding. She is a hoary pandemonium of ills, enlarged glands, mumps, quinsy, bunions, hay fever, bed sores, ringworm, floating kidney, Derbyshire neck warts, bilious attacks, gallstones, cold feet, varicose veins. A truce to Thranes and Crentals and Jeremies, and all such congenital defunctive music. 20 years of it, regret them not. With thee it was not as with many, that will and would and wait and never do. Thou sawest thy America, thy life task, and didst charge to cover like the transpontine bison. How saith Zarathustra, deine Kuh trübsal melkest du, nun trinkst du die süße Milch des Euters. See, it disposes for thee in abundance. Drink, man, an udderful. Mother's milk, Purefoy, the milk of human kin, milk too of those burgeoning stars overhead, rutilant in thin rain vapour, punch milk, such as those rioters will quaff in their guzzling den, milk of madness, the honey milk of Canaan's land. Thy cow's dug was tough, what? Aye, but her milk is hot and sweet and fattening. No dollop this, but thick, rich, bonny clabber. To her, old patriarch, pap, per diem partulam et per tundum nunc est bibendum.
Nope. So, not all clear. The air without is impregnated, a good word here, with rain-dew moisture. They're outside now. Life essence celestial, glistening on Dublin stone, there under star shiny, curum, Latin for sky. God's air, the All-Father's air, scintillant, circumambient, sessile air, scintillating, surrounding, and retreating air. Breathe it deep into thee. By heaven, now is a kind of praise of the Father. Theodore Purefoy, thou hast done a doughty deed, a brave deed, and no botch. Thou art about the remarkablest progenitor, barring none, in this chaffering, all-including, most ferruginous chronicle. Chaffering, all-including, ferruginous is a mixture of all kinds of food that you do. And of course, that is also a description of Ulysses. Chronicle. Astounding. In her lay a God-framed, God-given, preformed possibility which thou hast fructified with thy modicum of man's work. Cleave to her. That is Bible. Adam and Eve shall cleave to each other. Same word as kleben. Serve. Toil on. Labor like a very damn dog, whatever that is, and let Scholomant and all Malthusiasts go hang. Malthus was the one at the, I think, beginning of the 19th century, who was the first to say that if the population increasing, there won't be enough food. So that has to do with birth control and all of that. The church didn't go along with it. Go hang. Thou art all their daddies, therefore, art drooping under thy load, remoiled with butcher's bills at home and ingots, not thine, in the counting house. Obviously, he hasn't got enough money at home, but in the bank, he is handling ingots of gold. Head up. For every new begotten, thou shalt gather thy Homer of right wheat. Here you don't have Homer, or think that Homer is a Hebrew measure of grain. A Homer is a thing, so it is. But it so happens that, of course, we also read Homer out of him. Still, thy fleece is drenched. That has something to do with another Bible character who had some argument with God, Gideon, his name, and he said, I believe you if I put the fleece on the ground and in the morning the ground is wet and the fleece is dry, and God did it, and Gideon said, now do it the other way. That's another story from the Bible. Dost end me Darby and Dolman. These are proverbial, an old couple that stays together all their life with his Joan. A canting jay, that is a kind of donkey, and the room-eyed cur dog are all their progeny. So it's those who do not have offspring. So, I tell you, that's the opposite of Kufa, he's a mule. Mules don't have offspring. They're sterile. A dead gastropod, without vim or stamina, not worth a cracked kreutzer. Copulation without population. No, see, Herod slaughter, Herod slaughtered the firstborn, the Christmas story, of the innocent were the truer name. So, abortion, and they have often been compared to the slaughter of the innocent children. Vegetables, forsooth, and sterile cohabitation. Give her, and now he is doing English meals. beefsteak, red, raw, bleeding. She is a kind of not fruitful woman, is a hoary pandemonium of ills, enlarged glands, mumps, quinsy, bunions, hay fever, bed sores, ringworm, floating kidney, Derbyshire neck, warts, bilious duct, gallstone, cold feet, varicose vein. All the, here in the chapter you get all the evils and diseases we can have. A truce to threens and trentles and jeremies, these are all poetic expressions of lament, of sorrow. And all such congenital defunctive music, music for funerals. 20 years of it, 20 years, of course, always reminds us of Odysseus, who was away 20 years of it. Regret them not. With thee it was not, as with many, that will and would and wait and never do. Thou sawest, thou America, thy goal, thy life task, and discharge to cover, like the transpontine bison, the bison that is across the sea in America. How saith Zarathustra? And here we have Zarathustra, and I don't think we have found this in German, deine Kuh Trübsal melkest du. Nun trinkst du die süße Milch des Euters. Now it comes to milk. And I don't know whether that is anyone. I don't think we've anyone found that in Zarathustra, mind you. And of course, Zarathustra's language is like that of the Bible. So it displodes for thee in abundance. He's now talking about milk. Drink, man, and udderful. Mother's milk, pure for it. The milk of human kin. Milk, too, of those burgeoning stars overhead. The Milky Way. Rutulent in thin rain vapor. Punch milk, such as those whales will quaff in the gossip den. Milk of madness, honey milk of Canaan's land. The land of milk and honey. In the Bible. So now he's pushing milk when they were run for the last drink of course, not milk, but beer. Thy cow's dirk was rough, what? Aye, but her milk is hot and sweet and fattening. Though dollop, but it sits rich, bonny clab, or that's milk in some way. To her old study, a pap, that is tits. And then in the per deum, partulum et perdundum, these are Roman goddesses of fruitfulness. Fruitfulness and birth. And then he says, nunc est bibendum. That means now it's time to drink, which is now, of course, a very common thing and often used. Nunc, let's go for a drink. But the origin is a Horace poem, and it was Cleopatra, the enemy of the Roman state, had died, and he celebrates that our enemy is dead now, so now it's time to drink. But that was for a momentous occasion. And now the other. And now here, there is a break in the chapter. It's now the end of the paradise with Carlyle. And what is now coming is they all rush out to the hotel, get out very quickly or two. And now what we have is nothing written, but something what they say. It is as though they had, which they couldn't, had a tape recorder or something like that, to say what they all say. This is in some way the most tricky, difficult part of the whole book. It isn't said who says it and why and all of that. It is, and there have been many a session that I also attended where we tried to figure out what is happening. And it's quite It's quite difficult and demanding. We have another reading, by the way, where they imitated with many voices. But here, so we won't get through the chapter, but you can hear the whole paragraph then. Yeah.
All offer a buster, Armstrong hollering down the street. Bona fides. Where you slept last night, Timothy of the battered Nagin? Like old Billy O. Any brollies or gum boots in the family? Where the Henry Neville Sawbones and old Chloe? Sora, one of me knows. Around there, Dicks, all with the ribbon counter. Where's Punch? All serene. Jay, look at the drunken minister coming out of the maternity hospital. Benedict that for somebody pretends days, patriot filiers, and make mister. The Denzel Lane boys, hell blast ye. Scoot! Right now, Isaac, shove me out of the bleeding limelight. You's join us, dear sir? No intrusion in life. Lou Heat, good man. Ali, send me this bunch. En avant, mes enfants. Far away, number one on the gun. Burks. Thence they advanced five parasangs. Slattery's mounted foot. Where's that bleeding offer? Parson Steed, apostate's creed. No, no. Mulligan, above there. Shove ahead. Keep a watch on the clock. Shocking out time. Mully, what's on ya? Ma mère, ma mariée. British Beatitudes. Ratam clam diggity boom boom. Eyes have it. To be printed and bound at the Druidrum Press by two designing females. Calf covers of piston green. Last word in art shades. Most beautiful book come out of Ireland my time. Silencium. Get a sport on. Tension. Proceed to nearest canteen and there annex liquor stores. March. Tramp. Tramp. The boys are attitudes. Marching. Beer, beef, business, Bibles, bulldogs, battleships, buggery and bishops. Where they're on the scaffold high. Beer, beef, trample the Bibles. When for Ireland, dear. Trample the tramplers. Thunderation. Keep the darn military step. We fall. Bishop's booze box. Halt. Heave-ho. Rugger. Scrum in. No touch kick. You hurt. Most of me. Sorry.
You see, this is quite a tough assignment, and you find out almost sentence by sentence. It takes some time. All off for a buster. Don't know what the buster is. It looks like an American word, obviously a drink. Armstrong looks like a name. They probably they join that hands, hollering down the street. Hollering, they're shouting, but the street is called Hollis Street. Here we are close to Finnegan's Wake, men. Bona fides means good faith. Now, that has to do with the Irish custom. If a hotel has a bar, if you're a traveler from 3 miles away, you still have the right for a drink, alcohol, after closing time. But you must be a bona fide traveler, that is, on good faith. It has to be true. And you can imagine that turns the whole nation, Irish nation, in bona fides travelers. So it's almost a joke. Where you slept last night? You can see this is somebody said, where did you sleep last night? Timothy of the battered Nagin. What is that? I was quite lucky to know he was younger than me, but still old Dubliner. And I asked him, and as it happened, he knew, and it's now in the books. There was an innkeeper by name of Timothy in the 18th century, and he had a battered Nagin. It was obviously a Nagin, a drinking vessel, which he dented. He gave it so that less liquid would go into it. So he was called Timothy of the battered Nagin. It probably was still a word around. Like old Billy O, English, like old something. Any brollies and gumboots in the family? You have to translate this. Any umbrellas, because it rained, or gumboots, galoshes of some sort, in the family? And then, where the Henry Neville Sawbones and no clue? What does that mean? Who is Henry Neville? Well, that is Cockney rhyming slang. Instead of where the devil, you would say where the Henry Neville. So it means where the devil is Sawbones. Well, the doctor Sawbones, and that's the doctor. And Old Clo, the Blooms, once sold Old Clo's. And so Bloom and the doctor, as we know, are staying behind. Sorrowanowy knows, nobody, not of them knows. Hello there, Dix. They say, oh, hello, Dick Dixon, come along. Forward the ribbon counter. I don't get that's a military command, forward the ribbon counter. It's often hurry like in the military way it does. Where's Punch? Punch Costello. All serene. That is what the watchman says at night. Everything is all right. And we don't know, you're not told, who is speaking it. Jay, look at the Dunk Minister coming out of the maternity hospital. These are the boys who are hanging around there who say, Jay, look at the drunken minister. That is Stephen, who is drunk and dressed in black, out of the maternity hospital. And somebody takes this up, probably Buck Mulligan, who then instantly, when you have a minister who says, Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, pater et filius, may bless you the omnipotent God for father and son. A make, mister. These are the boys. A make is a coin. They're asking for a bit of that. The Denzil Lane boys, somebody says. These are the boys hanging around Denzil Lane. Hell, blast you. Scoot, right ho, that's probably. Then Isaac, shove them out of the bleeding limelight. That is obviously Cockney, that I'm not imitating, that somebody does, and there's no Cockney there. I said, shove them out of the light, shove them away, the bleeding limelight. So that's it. So it's Cockney. I don't know who says that. And then, and that seems to be Bloom, who has come now, and they, in a kind of mockingly polite way, say, you join us, dear sir? To Bloom, no intrusion in life. It is no intrusion. Now, why intrusion? Because Cockneys are known to drop the H. They don't say and so on and on. But sometimes in overcompensation, they add an H where it doesn't belong. It's no intrusion. So it's, Lou Heap, good man. That is a kind of pigeon English. You're a very good man. Or you say me this once, we're all the same here. And then somebody, probably Lenehan, says, en enfant, en avant, my enfant, in French. Fire away number one on the gun. Military command, artillery. Bucks, the pub is called Bucks. That's the goal. Then advanced five parasangs. What is that? That is probably Buck Mulligan. When you read Greek, the easiest text is the Anabasis by Xenophon, which is a military excursion. And it says, it's easy, it always says, and today we advanced 17 parasangs, that's a measure of length, so and so many miles. So that is, that means I have read Xenophon, probably Buck Mulligan. And then you get slapped his mounted foot. Where's that bleeding offer? The bleeding offer, Stephen. Slapped his mounted foot. That is the famous Irish song about somebody slattery who had a regiment. Mounted foot is light infantry. Mounted means they have horses, but they're foot soldiers. And it's one of my favorite songs. They have a regiment that doesn't go to war, but doesn't only attacks pubs and inns and drinking places, and they have a great line: "For who runs away from the battle will fight, will live to fight again. If you never fight, you stay alive." So it's a nice anti-military song. Parson Stephen is dressed like a parson, black. Apostate's Creed. Now, you have in religion and in Catholicism, you have the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed: "I believe in God, the Father Almighty." We had it several times in the book, "and who made the heaven and earth," and all of that. But an apostate is when you've broken away from the church, which Stephen has. So it's quite an it's basically the atheist creed, that kind of thing. Next episode, no, Mulligan. Abaft here, that is nautical, this way. Shove ahead. Keep a watch on the clock. It's chucking out time at 11. Everybody is chucked out. And that's quite a tough job to get them out, because pubs are fined if they stay overnight. But it is handled very loosely. Marie, what's on you? What do you have? And then somebody sings, for whatever reason, a French song, "Ma mère m'a mariée." And then somebody says, "British Beatitudes." Before that, you have "Beneficat," bless. Now, as you know, on this, or as older readers knew, and we don't always, there is in the church the 8 Beatitudes, because in the Sermon on the Mount, Christ said, "Blessed are the children, blessed are those," and there are 8 of them. "Blessed are beati sunt," and these are the beatitudes, the blessings. And here that somebody calls for British Beatitudes. And then they are singing a military song to the rhythm of Rattenplantigidi Bum Bum. Somebody, probably Lenehan, says, "The eyes have it." That is when you have a vote and a board, and you vote the eyes and the nose, and they say the eyes. Everything is in favor of going for the drink. The next thing must be said by Mulligan, who said this: "To be printed and bound at the Druiden Press by 2 Sinai female, calf covers of piston green, last word in Archie, most beautiful come out of Ireland my time." He said something must be printed and bound at the Druidrum Press. That was where Yeats had some very expensive books of poetry. That was the calf that was on piston green, the Irish colour, piston, last word in Archades, and then most beautiful come out of Ireland at that time. That is what Mulligan said in the library. Stephen should have said about in a book, "That's the most beautiful book come out of Ireland with things of Homer." I stop here because the going is very slow, and next time we read it again and I do this. This is, as I said, the part that is very slow. Well, each, you wonder what is being said, who may say it, with what kind of joke behind. Nothing is said straightforward. And that, as we heard time and again, is something some Irish are good at, turning everything into a linguistic event or something, or a quotation or an imitation. It is one, I think, of the Irish glories, but it makes understanding a little bit difficult. And so what I do is only guesswork based on many common sessions and what I have read. but there's still things to be explained. So we will proceed wisely. And silentium is a good word to stop. Silentium, of course, in Ireland is German student talk. Silentium. Okay. We'll finish it before long, but it's still tough going. It's a heavy labor, this chapter. Good. See you next time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.